a lot of company, what they do, they ask their network. So they ask the people within the company if they know someone, you know, like word of mouth, because it costs way less money, but also because if you trust someone and they trust someone, then maybe it can be a good fit. Also, if you have someone already in the company who kind of they know the company, you know, so they know if it will fit their friend or not, something like that. So I would say that's the complicated part, is that I think the all jobs offer you see on LinkedIn, they're the tip of the iceberg, and a lot of offers, they're actually hidden until they don't find anyone, and then they have to put it publicly.
Hello, everyone. This week, I'm talking to Stephanie Walter, who is a UX researcher and designer specializing in enterprise UX and mobile. Stephanie shares her career journey, the pros and cons of designing for enterprise, and cultural differences at work. She talks about experimenting with AI tools and their shortcomings. Also, Stephanie shares advice on tapping into the hidden job market, why she chose PDF format for her portfolio, and much more. Enjoy. Well, hello, Stephanie. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. And I was looking forward to this conversation. Your profile really stands out from everyone else. It's a very unique path with lots of unique experiences and very interesting background. So I'm looking forward to learning from you. Let's start with I guess your origin story. And why did you get into UX, and how did you end up at Maltem, where you're at right now?
Sure. So I wanted to be an English teacher at the beginning. And at the very beginning, I wanted to be veterinary, like taking care of pets, but then I wanted to be an art teacher and then an English teacher. And then I discovered there was a master's degree in Strasbourg that was mixing languages and the creation of web content. And like, I think I have a blog since I'm 15 now. So I started playing around with the blog, and then I was super frustrated because I wanted to change the design. So I had to learn CSS in order to do that. And when I saw there was a master degree that was kind of a mix of creating website, but also languages, I was like, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I could do that. So I basically decided to do that master degree, which means I had to go through a bachelor. So I basically chose my bachelor. Like, which bachelor do I need to go into the master degree, you know? So I did a bachelor degree in foreign languages, which led me to do a whole semester in Germany. It was very, very funny to learn about search engine optimization in English, in German, like so engine Optimisierung. Okay, what the hell am I doing here? So it was very funny. And then after the bachelor, I went to the master degree. It was very nice. And I had to do an internship. So I did an internship in Germany with a company where I was supposed to redesign a website, and I designed it too fast. So they needed to give me stuff to do. And they were like, okay, you know what? We have BlackBerry native applications, so we need to do some iOS ones. Do you want to try that? Like, okay, I know nothing about mobile design, but let's do this. And Apple has amazing guidelines. So they have this human interface guidelines, something like that, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of things around that. So I started looking at those. And then it kind of clicked, because they were a little bit talking about UX design without really mentioning it. There was stuff about doing usability testing. And we got some class around usability testing when I was in the master degree, but it was kind of one small class. And I kind of discovered UX through the lens of the mobile design and Apple. And then I kind of started digging into the topics and more books and all of that. So now, then after my internship, they decided to keep me. So I spent, I think, 2 years there. It was really nice. Then I went back to France, where I worked for a web agency. So I discovered the amazing life of agency, which is fun,
amazing,
but
in quotes.
Also, No, depends. I think there's good things. Like, if you like to change project quite often and discover new thing and learn about topics you knew nothing about with different clients, it's very, very, very cool. But at some point, I was kind of getting a little bit frustrated to be kind of one small part of a project, and then it would ship to the client. You don't know if they're going to implement the design. Then you discover they didn't use the design, or they completely changed the design.
Yeah.
So it was, I think I did 4 years there. It was very cool. But also, this is where I learned more and more about accessibility. So it was super interesting, but I always said, yeah, if I leave them, I leave the country. It's weird, like, you know, I was in Germany, I'm in France, like, oh yeah, if I leave them, I'm just going to leave the country, you know, casually. And actually, that's what I did. So after that, I got a job at the University of Luxembourg as a UX research assistant in the HCI team. So HCI is human-computer interactions, for those who are not aware of. So there I work directly with different projects, including something that is not at all computer-related, but we apply the user-centric process to design collaborative learning spaces for students, which was kind of more like service design, I guess, but also a little bit of space design. We had an agency specialized in space design to help us, and we were not just like randomly doing stuff. So it was quite nice, because then I had this kind of UX background, mostly through books, conferences, articles. So it was really, really nice to work at a university in more kind of a scientific way, to get more academic process, you know, more kind of strengthen a little bit my process. So that was very interesting for me. And also, it was why I went there. I was like, okay, you know what? I have this background. It's kind of not really officially background in UX. I'm lacking some maybe discipline, stuff like that. So let's go in academia, because then I could learn a lot. And yeah, after that, I went back to private sector in Luxembourg. So I worked for a consulting company before the one I am today. So I worked a lot with different sectors, and then it was mostly enterprise UX, which meant I mostly worked on products and tools that were used by internal users. So it was either we design with them inside the company, or we have a software as a service product and we sell them to basically their internal users. So we had this product around the automotive industry, this super big product, super complicated, a lot of stuff. It was quite interesting to kind of actually work on products that are not like, you know, B2C, like, oh, I work on a blog, or I work for e-commerce, but like, oh, I work for something super complicated that is for the end user at the end of the day, and they're kind of within the company and supposed to help them do their daily job. So this is kind of where I kind of discovered enterprise UX, and really the art of designing, doing research for things that are going to be used by end users that are inside a company, mm-hmm. and not necessarily like I'm designing an app. It's going to go on Apple Store, Android Market, and that's it, you know. So yeah, then I switched company to work at a bank. It was kind of like it is today, but for other reasons. So basically, what happened with the bank is, someone bought the bank, and like on Monday they told my head of UX, we had a team of 10 designers, on Monday they told you, yeah, don't worry, you can keep the whole team. And on Wednesday they were like, oh no, you can keep your three internal people, all the consultants, they just go away. So it was like, okay, so they basically fired 60% of people, consultant and a few internal people. It was super weird, bittersweet. Like, we had 2 months where everyone was leaving and we were all looking for new missions. So I was like, oh, where do you go next? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to that client. So, oh, me too, fun. See you in 2 months.
See you then.
No. See you. That's Luxembourg, you know, it's super small. So it was very kind of weird. But since they mostly fired the consultants, most of us, they were kind of paid with a consulting agency. So we got to keep the job since usually the consulting agency, they keep you on the bench and they find you a new client. So it was not like the big layoff that we have at the moment where people actually get fired. It was more like, okay, it's annoying, you have to find a new client, but at the same time, you're not kind of without a job, you know. Mm-hmm. So I found a new client, and then I found another one and came back to European Investment Bank, which is my current client. And there I'm basically working on the migration of a super big tool that is used every day by a lot of people in the bank, which is a project management tool, kind of-ish. It's very complicated to explain what it is. It's basically you do a loan, but it's the European Investment Bank, so you don't do a loan. A country or kind of a big entity does a loan. They need to, I don't know, build a bridge or make a new road somewhere. And then the Europe can say, you know what, I can finance this up to 50% of the whole stuff. So you have to create a whole project. So we kind of create the project. We have people who draft contracts. We have then you have the whole cycle of disbursement, reimbursement of loans. But you also have like architects and people who actually check that the building was built, that the bridge was built, that the road was built. So kind of engineers and a lot of people like that. So this is a tool that lets you kind of manage in a broad sense, the whole thing. And it was built 18 years ago, and we are migrating to a new design and new technology. And so, yeah.
You're leading the design efforts on this one.
I'm a UX team of one.
You are the on only this one. Oh, no.
Ooh. Yeah. The team is also super small. I'm working with two amazing front end, two amazing back ends, and tester, one PM, and that's it.
That's like really lean.
And two analysts. Yeah, it's a very small team.
Yeah, but how you just described the nature of this product when, and this is super familiar to me. So I've struggled trying to explain, especially because I also love enterprise software much more. And I think for the same reasons as you do. So I tried some B2C kind of experiences a while ago, and frankly, I didn't enjoy it. First of all, the visual design layer is not kind of my, I would say, strength as I would love it to be. And I love everything that happens right before that, as I mentioned earlier. And that's what actually enterprise gives, because like the last piece is probably the least important on all the other priorities, and the complexities, from what I've seen so far, is much more complexity comparing to a typical consumer application. Because first of all, the tasks would be simpler, and consumers are more demanding from just simplicity of the experience, and they won't bother going and trying to figure out, right? When enterprise kind of clients and users, they're stuck. They will have to learn it. And
they are stuck, but yeah, they are super demanding. I have people who count how many clicks. It's like literally, yeah, but this is an extra click, and I have to do this task 20 times a day. So I kind of would like not to have an extra click in the new interface. Like, yeah, that actually makes sense. But yeah, what you're saying is like there's a lot of guidelines. If you look at UI or even like UX, like, oh yeah, make it simpler, remove clutter and all of that. When I see those articles, you know, yeah, I'm just laughing. Exactly. Like, yeah, you wish. And then you're like, yeah, I have 17 column table, and if you follow those guidelines, it's like, yeah, yeah, remove some columns,
exactly.
And then you talk to the business and you talk to the users, and they're like, yeah, I don't need all the column all the time, but I need them to be here because I need to see the data as a global view, because then I see it's like Schrodinger's cat. I need to observe it in order to know if I need it or not. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't need all the column, as in, okay, this column, but maybe if I see something wrong with this one, then I might kind of draw connection and stuff like that. So you're like, yeah, so obviously 17 columns it is.
yeah. It's the same like with this kind of all the negative space discussions and advice, like add more space, when actually in the enterprise world, it's almost like against that. They're like, everybody's like we need more data packed in the like in a smaller area. And what's fascinating,
I have people. I have people telling me there's too much white space. There's almost no white space left on the interface. We already reduced the fonts and the spacing and the padding. And they're like, no, but there's still too much white space. So yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sounds very, very familiar. And but on the other hand, like, I think it adds more constraints to you as a designer.
Yeah.
And when there's like this conformist artificial pressure and limitations around you and like around what you can design and the solutions you can create, I believe actually constraints are good. And the more constraints you have, the more creative you have to be to design something. And it's just like free form, like do whatever you want. So from that point of view, I love enterprise. But talking about enterprise, this is a question I had for you. Besides kind of, I guess, besides the fact that you enjoy the complexity, right, that you mentioned, and you touched a bit on the positive sides, that you enjoy the complexity, but also on the negative sides that sometimes the demands are even a bit outrageous from the going back to like maybe Excel era of the standards, like the spacing in particular and all these elements. It's like more data-rich experiences that enterprise folks tend to love, right? More functional. So they'd want to avoid scrolling, clicking, just give me everything as much as possible on one screen, right?
Yeah, which, that's basically it.
Yeah. So can you maybe elaborate a bit more, especially because you've had several different parts of your journey where you worked in enterprise, right? Like as an in-house and as a consultant. I would like to hear your experience about the good, the bad, and the ugly of enterprise design. And maybe add a layer on top of this. What kind of designer you think will love enterprise? Because maybe like lots of people start with B2C, right? Because it's easier. But maybe somebody should be looking at enterprise design as their next step in the career. And maybe actually somebody should not be looking at enterprise design because they will struggle there. Maybe you have some insight there.
Yeah, sure. I'm always joking because I worked on cognitive biases, and to give you context, we have this UX in Lux meetup, and we do kind of workshops, and we built a whole deck of cards to help a little bit teach people about cognitive biases. And what we do is usually we ask them to use the biases into kind of an evil experiment, an evil website where they would basically manipulate people into buying stuff. And the cool thing with enterprise UX is you're not really trying to get people to buy stuff. It's like they have a task to accomplish. They're doing their job. So you have no one pressuring you into putting all of those kind of shady patterns like there is only free room left, book quickly, or, you know, all of that kind of stuff that you see on, sorry, but Amazon and what's the name, booking.com and website where you have, yeah, everyone does it, exactly. So the cool thing with enterprise UX is you don't have to do that because at the end of the day, the people are here mostly because they have tasks to accomplish. So you kind of, how would I say that, kind of can stay away from all the messy and the things that maybe sometimes annoy some of the designer. If you're like really ethical designer, it's sometimes kind of a little bit complicated if you have to design a pattern that is manipulating people. So that's a very, very good, cool stuff. The other thing I love about that is like you feel like a detective, which is a good and a bad thing. Because often you have a super complex problem presented in front of you. Like you have a user need and then you start digging into actually what their current solution or how can they do that. And then you start digging into the business and like, oh my God, this is such a mess. How am I ever gonna first understand this? That's the start. And then second, propose a solution to those users. So, and then you kind of start unpiling the stuff, talking to users, talking to people, and you, all of a sudden, you kind of, the little pieces of the puzzle kind of come into place until you're like, huh, actually, I think I can understand that. So maybe we could try this, this, and this. So it's kind of very scary at the beginning because it sounds so complicated, especially like in the bank business, since it's not just like banking, it's like a lot of things around it. As I said, we have lawyers who have to draft contracts. We have engineers who have to go to the places to check that it was built the way it was supposed to be built. So all of those people, they have very different needs and they're completely different areas of expertise. So you kind of have to start understanding all the business needs. So it's super scary, but at the same time, it's really, really rewarding when you're like, actually, this makes sense. I think I might have found kind of a nice idea to do that. So I would say it's an amazing area for the UX researchers and information architects. People, because you get a lot of complexity and most of your job is going to be try to understand what people are trying to accomplish and then try to provide an interface that is going to help them do that. But also you need to understand all the business behind that. Then it's absolutely not for people who want to do fancy, shiny stuff. Like if you want to do if you're super into latest design trends and you want to have this kind of amazing portfolio, all the wow effect and all of that, it's like, yeah, no. Basically it can be fun, but I think you would be super frustrated super quickly because there's, as you said, so many constraints, and people see sometimes it as a lack of creativity. I'm saying if you can fit 17 columns into a small screen, this is kind of a whole other level of creativity, you know?
Jedi level, yes.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's kind of not creativity as in, oh, I'm drawing cool stuff, but you still have to be very creative into your problem solving skills. So I would say, yeah, if you're not afraid of complexity, if you kind of thrive into organizing stuff. So again, everyone loving information architecture, I think they will love all the challenges in enterprise UX. Then that's definitely a nice area. The other thing that can sometimes be tricky, but I don't know if it's just enterprise UX, but I think it's more when you are in an internal within a company, is instead of getting all the you have to manipulate users, sometimes you get a lot of politics. You discover silos, but I think it's the same. It's also the same if maybe you work in B2C. But since in enterprise UX, when you work within the company, you're working directly with employees who have to do tasks on their daily job, maybe you kind of feel the silo a little bit more. The silos are kind of the internal politics and all of that. So I think it's also, maybe it's a little bit tricky if you're a junior, if basically you sent a loan to a client that is an enterprise client and you're a junior. And when I'm saying junior is like you never really worked in IT or in a company, because maybe you're a junior in UX, but you had years of project management or development, so you're kind of used to politics, then you could survive. But if you're completely junior, fresh out of school, you're going to get eaten alive if you arrive in a company with a lot of politics and
in this jungle.
I'm talking to a lot of designers, you know, it's just not my own experience here. It's really like as soon as you are internally within a company and not as a consultant or an agency, then you tend to get swallowed into politics, and sometimes it's really, really hard. So you need to become either super strategic or you need to have someone to help you. So I would not recommend being a consultant alone junior in enterprise UX. Unless, you know, do you have other people around you? That would be nice. But yeah, it can be a little bit tricky.
Yeah, you're totally right. And I think it goes back to, especially like for, I think an important point here is for folks who are switching careers from something else, right? The previous career, like lots of people just dismiss the value of being of having experience in the previous career, but at least even if it's not like IT related career, it still teaches you communication skills, all these social interactions, and potentially that can potentially help you in building trust in this company and navigating those jungles of politics and relationships, because you're totally right. Like especially a consultant, it's really hard to push your ideas through if you don't have the support either from somebody at the leadership level, or if you don't have these skills on your own, like to build it slowly potentially, but in a smarter way, kind of your way up that bureaucracy ladder, so to say. And you also write that, from my experience, it's not necessarily enterprise stuff. It's really kind of even B2C companies can suffer. I think it's just specific to maybe the top leadership, because I believe all mm-hmm. these practices, all the, I guess, the mindset about how decisions are made, how people, I guess, try to manipulate decisions in the company, it all goes from the top, either by design or by lack of, I guess, leadership. That's at least my
trust.
Opinion. yeah. So, yeah, I think it could be anywhere. Yeah, interesting point. And but one additional point that I would add, because all amazing points and all each point resonated with me as a person who loves enterprise, on every single one. One additional point that also I'm super, super in love with is direct access to users in most cases. So for my, I guess, particular, my design process, I love when I can have frictionless access to my target audience at any time. And I love this mm-hmm. at every single job that I've had before. When I had direct access to users, there was a clear connection to my happiness at work and my satisfaction from job. And all these additional layers of even like going through waiver forms and like finding all these gift cards to get, like all this, like, and sometimes you're not allowed to talk to your end customers when you work like in B2C environment. So
that's the thing. Yeah. So I love that in my current job because I'm allowed to, but I also know a lot of people who work in enterprise who can't. Because politics, like I know some people who worked for institutions where they were told like, those people are super important. You can't just like go and ask questions to someone that important, you know. So I love that. But at the same time, it might not be true for every enterprise UX. So, and I think that's the worst, you know, if you work on a product and your user are literally like in the next building and for political reason, you're not allowed to talk to them. I don't know if it would not be worse than actually not being able to, or just you do like that's cool with being a consultant though, is that you're like me, you're sneaky. You try to find ways to talk to them anyway, but then yeah, you might piss off the wrong person, and so it's always a little bit complicated.
It's a difficult game to play, yeah. And with I guess the more companies you experience, the more, I guess, different team dynamics you try firsthand, mm-hmm. the more you learn what works and what doesn't work. So I think variety of different experiences would be a good strategy or tactic to aim for, to learn different, almost like life hacks, right, that you can apply in different types of environments and different cultures as well. Speaking of cultures, what I found interesting in your profile, especially interesting in your profile, is that you have a diversity of experiences working with different countries, right? Or at least clients with different countries or users of different countries. I wonder if you can share any maybe patterns or any comparisons between the cultures that you at least experienced. Who knows, maybe some folks are more like straight to the point and really detailed oriented. Some folks are actually less. So it's kind of, I'm curious about this ethnographical component of this.
It depends, honestly. That's the cool thing though about Luxembourg is it's kind of German-ish. The language is officially German and French plus Luxembourgish, but kind of the mentality is more like German than French, for me, at least from what I've seen. But at the same time, there's a lot of people who come from all over the world. So in Luxembourg, it's really funny because you get to experience different culture, even within your team. You know, like I work with the two guys from Brazil, some people from Belgium, some people from Ukraine. There we have kind of, I think, almost every European country at some point in the building, and people from outside of Europe. So that's a very, very interesting thing. So I don't think I've experienced that many cultural differences because, as I said, I worked in Germany, then in France, then in Luxembourg. Oh, no, wait. Yes, Germany. Ah. I have to tell that story because it's amazing. So the big difference culturally in Germany for me is lunch. Like in France, it's sacred. Sometimes you take 2 hours. You have the bread, the cheese, the wine. And you're like, you know, even with colleagues, it can last forever. Germany, nope. German is like, I think it's like a little bit in the Netherlands, you know, like lunch is just, you need food to keep your day going and you want to have a super small lunch break so that you can go home early, from what I've experienced with like the German people. So we went to that client and I don't remember, they were doing kind of, how would I say that, reseller, but kind of not drop shipping. They had kind of a white label platform where people could resell stuff, except that it's not like Amazon or AliExpress where you resell small stuff. It was actually where you can sell anything in construction sites. Like you need 100 bathtubs, they can, and you sell those, they build kind of build your e-commerce, you know. So very already enterprise industrial stuff. And we were going to do some testing on the mobile app in their office. So I arrived and on the left, there was like in kindergarten, you had these little boxes and you had the shoes in there. So like basically you have to imagine a company where you have like people with suits, but they just leave their very horrible shoes at the entrance and put the most comfy slippers ever. So I arrived there and I see like people with suits and slippers. I'm like, wow, this is such a good idea. And then for lunch, they're like, yeah, we ordered pizza and we will keep on testing while eating the pizza. And then it's like, okay, very efficient, you know. So we ordered the pizza. We kept the test during that. But then at 4 o'clock, it was the end of the day, you know. It's like we basically kept on working while having lunch. And that was it. So that's kind of the most kind of biggest trend I've seen is more like on the lunch side, like French more love their 2 hours lunch break. So like going to the restaurant, taking a lot of time. And Germany was very, very efficient, you know.
Very interesting. So, and I don't have, I guess, enough experience working with folks from European countries to draw any conclusions. So like I haven't really noticed any clear patterns, or I haven't got any funny stories like this one yet, at least. Hopefully there will be some entertaining observations coming soon. But because you were born in France, right?
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could share maybe just kind of on a not really work-related angle, but just culture, right? And how, like, this behavior that you notice during the work at work setting in Germany, does it align with, I guess, global country specific cultural nuances and maybe some patterns, like about the efficiency? Because I've heard this from other side of the ocean, from Canada. But I've never kind of really experienced this. So it's really hard for me to, it was hard for me to kind of understand what exactly people mean. So maybe you have any examples there?
The issue is I was born in France, but my native language is not French, it's Alsatian, which is a dialect from German. And I've always lived next to the German border. Oh. And the region where I was born used to be German, then French, and German, depending on the war. So I'm not really a good example of a French person because I always felt more like European, you know. Like when I went to Switzerland, I completely forgot that I needed an ID card, and then they didn't take euro. Because when I was working in Germany, I would just cross the bridge by bike every day. So going to Germany was like, yay. And then I took the train to see some friends in Switzerland. And in the middle of the trip, I was like, oh, yeah, right. They're not in the euro stuff. So
different country. Huh,
true. So like Europe was so kind of something I took for granted that I completely missed that about Switzerland. So I think it depends. Even in France, you know, like the people in the south, I know a lot of people who live in the north of France who don't like to work with the south because they are kind of south mentality, kind of a little bit lazy, you know, like all of those shitty cliche about people in the south when there's some sun. So no. I think even in France, you have so many regions and all of that, that everyone has cliché about the other person. But at the end of the day, I don't really know if you're going to be that much influenced by the region you live in. So, except food. Like food definitely is a big topic in France. Like you don't mess with food.
Everywhere.
This. also one big difference is that maybe it's not that cultural, or maybe it is in France, you don't have to pay for water. It's like this is the big thing that was kind of surprising to me when I came to Germany and to Luxembourg, is you don't get free tap water at the restaurant. You have to pay for it. So if you just want a small glass to take medicines, sometimes they're nice. They will just give you kind of a few drops. Otherwise, you have to pay a whole bottle of mineral water. While in France, everywhere you go, you just get kind of a carafe d'eau, which is kind of a big glass of water, or even a bigger container of water, and that's for free, you know. So
yeah, and this is
where this comes from.
This is an interesting shock coming from Canada, because there you can get tap water as usual everywhere.
Yeah,
and here's like you have to pay for everything, like even like anything. And I loved it
and
in Switzerland.
Beer is cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah, give me this day instead. Yes. Yeah. So lots of interesting differences, actually. Yeah, kind of. I'm capturing all my observations between Vancouver and Luxembourg on my blog. So yeah, lots of differences. The vast majority I enjoy, or at least find okay, but some things are quite irritating, frankly, for a person, for example, who doesn't smoke. All the smoking comparing like Vancouver and Luxembourg is a big difference. But I'll have to adjust. And
what's the difference with smoking? Because it's forbidden in restaurants in here.
In a nutshell, in Vancouver, very few people smoke cigarettes. And by cigarettes, I mean tobacco. Like, of course, like inside it's prohibited, but even outside, like you can, it's very rare where you can feel smoke. Like you can smell smoke outside, and here it's almost everywhere.
It's worse than that. The problem with Luxembourg is the VAT is quite smaller on cigarettes and tobacco than the other countries around. So before leaving Luxembourg, the only thing I knew about Luxembourg is that my friends who were in the north of the country would go there to buy cigarettes and bring back cheaper cigarettes from Luxembourg. So I don't know if it's related. Like, I think they did some statistics some years ago, and they kind of checked how many cigarettes were sold in the whole country per day compared to the population. I was like, you know, the math doesn't add up because there's a lot of people who buy and then leave the country. But if you added that, it was like everyone in Luxembourg from the age of 5 was someone who's smoking, you know, if you just look at the data. So that's kind of, no, actually, that's not true. It's just a lot of people, they just buy and then they grab to go.
It's a funny story, but I think it's actually a really good point that can be relevant to our, I guess, main topic of the conversation. That just looking at data is not enough, right? So, and quite often there could be situations and risky decisions could be made if you just look at the numbers and don't try to understand the context and the real situation by doing maybe more qualitative research than just looking at web analytics traffic, right? And like why people leave. So I think that's an interesting segue into that, into UX world. okay, so let me look through the questions, because we kind of actually one more question I had for you in regards to your story, and then we'll switch to the more career advice. You published a book, right?
Yes.
Could you, first of all, tell me why you did this? Why did you decide to do it as a book instead of more like content like you create these days? What maybe lessons learned you have from this experience about the process itself and about maybe yourself as well? Like, because some folks find that they learn something about their personality when they write a book, when they just kind of force themselves to go through this experience. Maybe there are some interesting observations from your story. And lastly, I'm curious to understand why it's only one book.
I think it all goes together by I wrote a book by mistake.
So
I didn't sign up for writing a book. I signed up for writing five chapters, not really training, but it's so I worked with SidePoint and they wanted to have my UX related content, and we talked about it, and they say, yeah, I think I could write five chapters, you know, on user journey mapping. And then I wrote the chapters and they were like, oh, actually you wrote them in a way that this would make a really nice book, you know. It's like very clear, very concise, is how to, and like those chapters, they just kind of worked so well together. And they were like, would you be open to us publishing this as a book, as an ebook, on top of having it as a kind of course in our Insight One? I was like, yeah, sure. So that was kind of fun. So it was super weird to say, oh yeah, actually, I kind of wrote five chapters and they turned it into a nice book.
Interesting.
It's really, really,
have you thought really of writing more, like intentionally?
Like, let's be honest, when at some point when you write articles that are like 30 pages long in Google Doc, like, this is basically already a book, you know. Like, some of the articles I have on my blog, they're kind of like mini small books. It's just that, I don't know, it's so I almost signed up for writing a book some years ago with a French company. And we're supposed to co-write with some other author, and they asked us to produce a first draft. So my draft was okay. His draft was not academic enough. So he rewrote it. They were not happy about it. And he went like, look, I'm going to have a baby. I want to write one book, not 10, aka I don't want to rewrite the same thing in another style all the time. So if you want to keep on without me, it would be fine. And I was like, you know what? I don't really like the way they're treating you. It's like the whole, yeah, this is not academic enough and all of that. And also at that time, I asked about the ebook and they didn't provide any PDF or actual ebook. You could only have it online on their platform, which meant you had to be logged in. There was no way to have it offline. I was like, so you're telling me I'm going to kind of get 5% on something I'm going to write and people will not even be able to have it on their Kindle, or kind of they will have to be connected the internet to read it. It's like, okay, there's the paper version, but as a big ebook reader, I'm like, you know what? I don't think it's a good fit for me. So,
and not so very, I gave up. But not very inclusive practice.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. They were more like making sure it's not gonna get pirated it's like, yeah, but I've read stuff, which means it's if someone pirates it, at least they will read it, you know. That's the thing. I'd rather have people read it so now if I ever actually write another book on my own, I think I will be self-publishing, to be honest. Or work with some people I really trust and who will give you more than 5%. Because, yeah. Like, seriously, like, those big companies, you get 5% on paper and ebooks. So on paper, okay, there's kind of paper, so you have to print, there's costs and all of that. But you could expect that maybe on ebooks you get a little bit more. There's no cost for printing. There's still all the cost of hosting, and I agree, like, they do some marketing sometimes, which is also sometimes very, very funny when you see the very little part of marketing they do for your own book. Mm-hmm. I have friends who published with some of those companies and they were super not happy about the marketing either. So this is why I think a lot of more authors knows those days. You see a lot of people, especially in technical book, they go self-publishing. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good way, because at the end of the day, then you get your revenue, you get full control. You still, I think, need to find an editor because typos and all of that. You might need to find one or two people to proofread the book. So there's a lot of stuff you have to do, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I would love to ask you about those publishing companies, but let's not give any names here, and we'll talk about this later. Just curious, yeah, because it sounds like outrageous, frankly. 5% and yeah.
5% for the first book, 8% for the second one if
still,
the first was a success.
It's ridiculous. You do all the work and yeah. And I would be, even if they did an amazing job in marketing, still I think it's ridiculous. The number is ridiculously low. Mm. Anyways, but back to your point about self-publishing and that you would still need a couple of, I guess, roles to help, right? And the editor is an example, and like proofreader. I think this is an amazing segue into one of the topics for the conversation today. So, because I've heard that some folks actually already almost outsource, not for books particularly, but for articles and like bigger content pieces, outsource editing and proofreading to ChatGPT and similar tools. So, what are your thoughts on that? Like on the overall developments that's I'm sure that you're aware, and what do you think this will cause to the whole like UX industry and UX profession, how it will change?
So the fun thing is actually, you know, the master degree I did, it's I had some class around automated translation tools. So I have a little bit of background on the thing that actually built ChatGPT. So I don't know if you're aware, but ChatGPT is based on language model, and those were basically developed at the very, very early beginning of that in order to help with translation. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing, which is really kind of funny. When I look at that, I'm like, wow, this is way more sophisticated than anything that we studied. So I think the technology is amazing. I also think a lot of people forget how it's working, in the sense of, I've seen people ask it to predict the future of UX and things like that. And I even think some people start thinking it's sentient because it's able to give good answers.
All right.
But it's just kind of, it's not fake, but it's deception. So it's just kind of a glorified autocomplete thing for now, like the model that we have today. Mm-hmm. I have no idea I know they're cooking a new thing, but the one that you can play with today, it's basically what it's doing is you ask it a question and it's looking into all of this data to find what's the next most probable word in the sentence that would make sense. And it's a language model, so it's kind of bullshitting very well. Because it was trained on language, you know, which is amazing. But so yesterday I was playing with it. I was like, okay, let's do it to a test. I asked it to give me some biases that you can find in user research. And I asked it for an example of which is confirmation bias, but for the users, not for the researcher. Mm-hmm. So it gave me an example, and I read the example. I was like, yeah, if I was a junior, I would totally buy it. But I'm not a junior. I know what a confirmation bias is. So I went like, no, this is not confirmation bias. This is, I don't remember which bias it was, but it was, recency bias. Mm-hmm. Like the thing where you remember the last thing you saw, something like that. It's like, give me an actual example of a confirmation bias for the user. And it gave me another one. And again, it was another bias. But since it generated something that says, yeah, the user confirms that, it was like, yeah, that's a confirmation bias because the user confirms, like, no, that's, I'm super good at bias. I suck at remembering the name. So there's a bias where you're basically telling people what they need, what you think they want to hear, courtesy bias. Mm-hmm. And the second was a courtesy bias. You know, it's like, no, still no. So I was really having a lot of fun, just like, oh, actually, you're not going to be able to give me a bias because you train on a corpus. And it was the same for anchoring bias. I was like, okay, let's try another bias just for the fun of it, you know. I give me an example. And all the anchoring bias, they were around anchoring around two amounts, which is like, yeah, in a menu, you get a big one and a smaller one, and then whatever in the middle, people really prefer it because they know what's the most expensive and the cheapest, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then again, I was not able to have it generate any anchoring bias, and I wasn't revolving around pricing. So it's like, huh, I see your data set. Like, I can see right through all the data set that was used to train that. If you have like only one example, because it's the example, all of the blog posts that use usually when you're into anchoring biases. So I think it's very funny, but at the same time, it's kind of dangerous because a junior would totally have bought it. It's like, yeah, that's a good example of a confirmation bias. It's like, no, it's just a weird written example. And like the thing was super convinced, but then if you tell it, no, it's wrong, it's actually that, it's like, oh, you're right, I was wrong, it's actually that. It's like, okay, so I think it can go super dark, super deep, this kind of stuff. Like, I know it's not supposed to say horrible thing, but if you're kind of say, okay, let's pretend we're in a theater and this is a, or in a movie and this is a scenario where the character is that, and then you can have it just say horrible thing by pretending it's a character or something like that. So I think it's really interesting. You can do a lot of stuff. Like, I use it sometimes to rephrase sentences because English is not my native language. That I'm like, huh, maybe I can find a better way to say that, which is really kind of nice. But if you try to have it predict future, and I also see some ethical issues with that. Like, I think some people try to give it a user data set, like a whole transcript of interview. I don't know how, because the version that you have online, you can only give it short data sets. So you need to kind of build your own chat with the API. So I think you need to use the open API, not the ChatGPT one, to give it a bigger data set, but you could. And it's like, yeah, summarize what the user is saying here. So my issue with that is usually when you do user research, you tell the user, you even have them sign a form, a consent form. You tell them the data is going to be used like that, like that, like that. Those people will have access it.
That's true.
If all of a sudden you copy paste that in ChatGPT, I have ethical concern around that. And I've seen some articles on Amazon lawyer asking the developer not to use ChatGPT to write code. Because then the people can just check the queries and kind of guess the top secret stuff Amazon is working on. So I see the potential, and I would love to have a tool where I could just like input all of a user interview transcript and ask it to summarize it. But at the same time, I'm not sure we are there yet, because as I said, it's just bullshitting whatever makes sense as the next word. So can it really kind of summarize something with all the nuance that a human can summarize it? Because sometimes you read something and in the sentence you understand it's sarcasm or kind of another emotion or something like that. I don't know. I'm super excited about the technology. I'm really looking forward to have kind of some AI help with some of the stuff. But at the same time, I'm also super cautious around that.
So, all valid points, and definitely the danger of misunderstanding, like what kind of what this response really is, because I've seen even like, and maybe not what you give an example about that you that if a junior researcher or designer would be looking at the results, they may take it for granted, like as it is. But I also think what's potentially even more dangerous, because at least junior person should have at least some expertise, at least somewhat, like in this field. But I'm more worried about people who are from the business side, or somebody who is not from the profession, and they're trying to dabble with the idea of replacing potentially headcount with like these kind of tools and technologies, right? And in most cases, for a person who is outside of this, because you knew it, like you're the expert, so you caught the problem. But if the person doesn't know, like the results, they look very convincing, frankly. And yeah, unless you really know that it's wrong, it's easy to believe that it's true, right? And that's kind of the problem that I see, because for a ton of people, for a lot of people who are like maybe who are business owners or some kind of managers who try to optimize their teams or processes, chances are there won't be a person next to them who would tell them don't trust it, like it's not true, yeah. Right? And they may take it like as truth, and who knows what decisions they will make. So it's definitely a risk. And even though I think ChatGPT is trying, if you can call it trying, by showing this pop-up, like kind of it can make mistakes and all that stuff, and it's like testing beta. As usual, people just, even myself, I notice, like I just kind of click through next to kind of go through this and like don't even see what's there, all these disclaimers, right? So lots of people will miss that warning. That's a risk. There was a point I wanted to ask. So you seem very optimistic about the technology, and I agree. It's definitely, I'm in awe. I was in awe when I first tried it, and like the more I use it, obviously, kind of the more you use it, you uncover more gaps and like more not as valuable outputs, right? Like as more like specialized knowledge, like biases. But with time, I think it's just a matter of time. Like you won't be able to find as many problems. But overall, you feel very optimistic, so you don't feel that it threatens UX as a profession, or perhaps maybe it will replace some parts of the UX design process, at least somewhat. What are your thoughts on that?
For me, as long as we'll have human beings to deal with and all the political business mess, there's no way we're going to be replaced. But at the same time, I could see how some people might think, okay, let's not do user research, just generate a bunch of persona with ChatGPT, and that's basically it. But then my question is, would you really want to work for a company who cares so little about your job that they're basically like, yeah, I think an AI can do it anyway? So that's the thing. It's a little bit like those logo generator, you know. It's like they're not threatening actual logo designers, because the target audience is people who would not hire a logo designer anyway. So it's kind of a first thing. So what threatens UX design is not AI. It's people who think they can do our jobs without training and things like that. But at the end of the day, the problem is those people will always exist. And if they're not using ChatGPT, they will use something else to... so that we can't basically do our job. So it's kind of, yeah, you know, the thing is, I don't think an AI can do most of what I do on a daily basis, like all of this complexity, understanding really the business needs and all of that. So I think if you're starting to be a UX designer who's more at a strategic or business level, really, really trying to understand all of that thing in order to make sense, for now, I don't foresee an AI capable of doing that. I foresee an AI capable of maybe transcribing some user interview. That would be amazing. I also see some AI able to kind of do some UI, because they will throw a bunch of components. But then again, will those work for all of the needs? You know, it's very like fluffy surface level. It's like, yay, look, it kind of made a cute little card with a title and an image. Like, yay, amazing. I'm looking forward to an AI who will be able to give it all the parameters of all my complex table, and it will build me a table. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Yeah. So I don't feel threatened, but as I said, I work on super complex topics with enterprises. So maybe in B2C, it might be a little bit tricky. But at the end of the day, you have people today who create fake personas, who create user journey based on whatever they imagine the actual journey is. So they're already not talking to users. So whether they are not talking to user and create a user journey on their own, or not talking to user and ask an AI to create it, at the end of the day, it's the same. They're not talking to users. So that's the thing. It's like so generic. That, yeah, of course, is people might think they can do our job with those, but will they do our job in the best way possible? I highly doubt that.
Yeah, I agree. I guess I still think that there will be like slowly more and more, I guess, deliverables would be, AI would be able to create. And like, even though now, like this, I think there was an example that I saw of a design, like a Figma generator or something, AI generator, when like onboarding experience for like a pet owner, social network or something like this, like as an example. And like it created like, I don't know, a page looking that I would not find any differences with any other onboarding mobile app screen. So it's kind of the same component, yeah, because it's easy, right?
Generic. Generic.
Yeah, very generic. But thinking like, especially how fast things have changed in the last few months, right? Or like a couple of years. I'm suspecting that like in 5 years, the capabilities will be much more advanced because it's exponential, right? So, and I see like the further you are to the release of the product, even like including coding parts of the, and like QA, right? Even QA, like it's already almost semi-automated and has been before even ChatGPT showed up. Like all the unit testing, like, and there's like automation testing tools, right? But the, with every next generation of these AI tools, the further you go to the release of the product, the more things they will be taking over. And that's why I think the visual design and like all the UI pieces at the end of the process, the icing on the cake, will be, I believe it will be first to risk automation more and more with every next year. And like, but more thinking and problem solving.
It's the same, not just with AI, you know, you had like Bootstrap, and then a lot of people say, yeah, I don't need a designer, I can just have a bunch of developers who will put a Bootstrap together. And then they put the Bootstrap together and
it's a
website, but it's an usability nightmare, you know. And then you have those days, you have those no-code tools where they're like, I don't even need a developer anymore. I don't need a designer. I have just like to plug this into a database. Yeah, I put a bunch of little blocks and that's it. But then, as you said, then we shift it to the left. We still need some people going into the strategic part, the understanding business, the understanding needs. So yeah, totally. Yeah. But it's not just AI. It's a lot of the tool that we have today.
Oh yeah, it was happening even before AI. Yeah, it's just kind of the scripting, automating. Yeah, so the more thinking and the more working with humans and analyzing almost like in between the lines insights, I think the harder it is for machine learning and language prediction systems to automate that, because it won't make any sense, I think. But we'll see. Like, it's really hard to predict what you don't know, what will happen in this space. Yeah, definitely exciting though. And I like your example of how you check some of your sentences and like ask ChatGPT to rephrase it. It's almost like that you already have a free editor for your next book.
Oh, I treat it like a glorified secretary, you know. Exactly. Like correct the typos and how rephrase that and exactly. Stuff like that. So
awesome. Okay, so this is a very, very exciting and interesting conversation. Let's touch a bit more, and we'll probably have to wrap up after that. Last question. So going back to the idea of really, and I think we touched on this before we started recording, on the job market right now, right? And all the folks who first of all got laid off, like really sad market situation right now, and doesn't seem that it's actually going away. So probably this year will be quite turbulent for many folks. But also from the point of view of the entry level and junior and like intermediate designers, who are now also, I think, somewhat competing with those experienced folks from the industry who just entered the market, right? So it's even more challenging for the less senior folks to find a job. So thinking from that point of view, could you share maybe some, I don't know, strategies, tips, advice? How would you approach job search today?
I think networking might be super important because you, like a friend of mine, they put a job offer and they got like 200 people, something like that, 200 resumes for one position. So, and the thing is, they started before putting it online, a lot of company, what they do, they ask their network. So they ask the people within the company if they know someone, you know, like word of mouth, because it costs mm-hmm. way less money, but also because if you trust someone and they trust someone, then maybe it can be a good fit. Also, if you have someone already in the company who kind of they know the company, you know, so they know if it will fit their friend or not, something like that. So I would say that's the complicated part, is that I think the all jobs offer you see on LinkedIn, they're the tip of the iceberg, and a lot of offers, they're actually hidden until they don't find anyone, and then they have to put it publicly, except for public sector. For those, they have to. They can't do the whole asking someone if you know. So this is specific, but again, so in general, it's like, I think you need to do some networking. I think you also might want to be honest, like saying, oh, look, I'm looking for a new opportunity, super precise about what you're looking for. It's like, okay, there's a lot of things, you know, you can do. Do you look for a specific area, kind of geographical, or do you look for a specific industry or something like that? So I would say if you put something on LinkedIn saying, I'm available, I'm looking for some work, maybe also say what kind of work, you know, like be specific. What do you want to do actually? Because then it can also kind of help narrow down on keywords. Yay. So it's a little bit tricky on that side. So yeah, I would say networking is kind of important. Like most of the jobs I got is because people already knew me one way or another, because someone introduced me before, or they knew about my blog or something like that. So definitely. Also, it's kind of proactive, I think, is even if you're not looking for a job right now, it's kind of a shitty moment. So I'm sorry, but be prepared to have a resume somewhere. Something like that. And same for portfolio. I've seen advice, and I think it's very good advice, which is if you just lost your job, you're not in a very good place to update your portfolio. So it's kind of better to be proactive, to always kind of update it even while you have a job, because then at least if you lose it, or if you don't lose it, but you're looking for something new, then you don't have kind of this giant mountain you have to climb, which is to update your portfolio.
Yeah.
Says the one who doesn't have any case study in her portfolio. But I have a PDF. I have some secret stuff. So it's not public, but I always have some PDF and things. So yeah, definitely. That's the annoying part with working, I think, in our industry, is you need to have something ready all the time, even if you're not looking, because you never know what might happen.
That's true. Do you have any tips on how, because networking is a great advice, and I agree, that can help you open some doors to companies and like through insiders, right? But on the other hand, thinking about the overwhelming number of messages and cold emails and cold messages, like LinkedIn connection requests, that hiring managers and folks who are on the hiring side receive these days, especially with all the layoffs. It's kind of, I think, I'm sure that they won't be able to check every single message. So do you have any advice and tips on how one could increase their chances of getting through this cold wall of networking?
I'm not a hiring manager, but I get a lot of people asking stuff from me on LinkedIn, and usually I reply when I see they put some effort into actually trying to understand who I am, know me, you know, when I can see it's not a copy-pasted message. So I think it might take time, but that's the important thing, is at some point, if you want to stand out from the crowd, you need to catch the attention. And like, hi, we live on the same planet and we are both UXers. I would like to connect. That's not a connection. You know, it's like, I'm kind of joking, but I've seen some messages that were just like, hey, we're both human beings. Let's connect. It's like, why? Give me a good reason. Actually, so I would say try to make it personal. Or if you can also, if you have someone you want to connect with and you see your second on LinkedIn, maybe you can ask for an introduction with people you first agree with, and you kind of can ask them to refer to you or something like that. So it's always kind of making sure you're not a total creep who sends a super generic message no one will want to answer to.
That's true. That's a good observation. So I just, while you were answering, I was thinking through, trying to remember the messages that were, even like sometimes when the messages are included, but this reads so generic, like clearly copy-pasted from and sent to like hundreds of other folks. And it does create this negative feeling, like really detracting from the connection request. I agree. Interesting. Okay, let me just quickly scan through the questions, okay, because I think there was one more point I wanted to touch, and then we'll close it. Okay, we're talking about this. Oh, actually, yes. You mentioned something that you have a PDF portfolio. Can you elaborate why PDF? Because there is like all this debate about web is better, PDF is better, nothing is better. Printout is better. So why PDF?
Because I would like to have a life outside of teaching, giving conferences, working, doing a lot of stuff. And basically, I kind of designed this amazing portfolio with some case studies. And then I was like, I need to code it. Crap. It's going to take me forever. So I have a WordPress site. It's not going to take me forever, but it's like, So yeah, I have a PDF portfolio because then I open Keynote and I update it. I can copy paste images. It's super simple. And but the thing is, I don't think I'm a good example because my blog and my website is more kind of like one of an agency, you know. I'm not really pushing forward the project I'm working on. I'm pushing forward the conferences and the workshops and the articles and all kind of the things I share. And I know that if I want to change job, I might have to kind of elaborate more, a little bit more, my case studies. So I'm not a good example. I'm kind of in a privileged position, I think, because I was able to build in the last couple of years an online presence that makes it so that for now, when I wanted to switch job, I kind of used my network and told people I'm looking, and then I was able to go through different connections and things like that. But I have 12 years of experience in a network, so it's kind of sounds like bragging, but at the same time, it's like, this is not good advice for beginners, because for beginners, if you don't have this kind of, if you haven't built it, I wish for beginners that in 12 years, you will arrive in a place where you don't have to have a super detailed portfolio and a lot of things in there. But PDF, because it's basically the easiest way for me to update it super quickly without having to go through all the WordPress loops, which is a WordPress joke.
Yeah. Yes.
So yeah,
I spent years dealing with WordPress myself, so that sounds too familiar, and I can totally relate to this ease of use and customization. Yeah, WordPress is—they're getting better, but still lots of work to do. Okay, last two questions, very quickly. If money wasn't a question, what would you do?
I have no idea.
What about your teaching passion, like really? And because you're very creative, you have so many different streams of activities outside of your day job.
Yeah, no, you haven't seen the latest mayhem with the stickers and the paper plan. I don't post them on LinkedIn because I'm like, I don't want LinkedIn to become like Facebook, but I'm basically doing a lot of craft stuff around paper and illustration and stuff like that. So I think it sounds cliche, but I would either maybe want to do kind of more art and craft, you know, if like money was not a problem at all. If I would kind of not have to pay my mortgage or anything, I think I would do something more kind of creative in a creative table way, but more like illustration and stuff like that. Or I would just like spend the day traveling and reading books.
That sounds like a dream.
That sounds good too. Like good tea, good books, and travel a little bit. And yeah, that would be fun.
That's good. Yeah, so, sounds cool. And last question, how can listeners connect with you online? I'll include, obviously, the link to your website. That's known. But anything else?
So yeah, I have the website, stephaniewalter.design. I'm mostly on LinkedIn. I'm still on Twitter for now-ish. Also on Mastermind. The thing is, I schedule most of my posts. So just because you saw me post something 2 minutes ago doesn't mean I'm behind my computer and you will get an answer in 2 minutes. But yeah, basically LinkedIn, Twitter, and Mastodon for now is the best places.
Sounds good.
Or people can just shoot me an email.
And you have all these contact details. And so you have a bunch of
on the site
forms per different types of requests or questions on the website. So they can find it there as well. Yeah, so you have like a contact section. And then if you want me to speak at this event, fill out this form. If you want me to go to a podcast, fill out this form.
No, I have an FAQ with questions, but I don't have specific forms. But I should, actually. I try to have subjects, but people would just pick the first one, so I gave up.
Oh. Okay. Awesome. Okay, thanks. Thank you very much, Stephanie. This was a very delightful conversation. I learned a lot, and we spoke on a few very exciting topics. And it was a real pleasure.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thank you.